Working dog stories from all around Australia. In dappled shade, mobs of sheep sit out the heat of the day. Cattle chew their cud contentedly. Big gums with peeling bark reveal smooth new skin beneath, and gum oozes from unhealed wounds where branches have snapped off in wind or still heat. Creeks and dams mirror tangled branches, red and white colored bark and glossy leaves. Grasses wave. In the air hangs eucalypt scent. Blue seedlings erupt after flooding and big rains. And a thick brown bark small lizards and ants live. While hollows shelter noisy corellas and galahs. A huge gum. Dense canopy against bright blue sky making grey-purple shadows underneath. Epitomizes grandeur and stateliness. This is the country where the topsoils are deep, water is plentiful, and the seasons relatively predictable. There are vineyards, pine forests, and irrigated crops, and predators like foxes, rabbits, bushfires, and tourists. There are also neighbours close by, and pubs. The dogs of the Big Gum Country have a particular tale to tell.
This one we've called Messiah of the Lambs, from Garth Duffield at Wellington in New South Wales. As a young man, I saw many funny incidents involving dogs, but I reckon that Sam, the Whippet Beagle Cross, one of the members of the rabbit pack, gave me the biggest laugh. Sam's position in the pack was semi-fast rank outsider in any chase, with very little chance of ever coming up with the prize money. It was a likeable dog, pure white, with black patches stretching up over each eye to cover his large floppy ears. This description's important. Mustering and lamb marking time had come round again. This particular year, we're a bit late and the lambs were wild and large. As the bellowing ewes hung back, all trying to find their lost lambs in the mob, the lambs started to ring the edge of the mob, with more and more joining in the frisky fun. I knew we were in trouble. I'd turned the surging tide back into the centre three times. Sheepdogs and motorcyclists were becoming frantic when strolling across the hill, fair bang in front of the mob, came Sam. You can't imagine what I called him. Sam knew he was in trouble and turned for home. At the same time, however, the lambs broke, and seeing a pure white comrade, albeit with black floppy ears, making a beeline away from the mob, they followed. Sam glanced back, but was not impressed to find upward of 300 charging lambs bearing down on him, and a further 400 screaming ewes coming after them. Sam changed into higher gear and headed for home. I was thinking murderous, unprintable, blasphemous thoughts about white rabbit dogs, but being dim-witted, as sometimes I am, I hadn't recognised heaven-sent assistance when I saw it. Sam bolted for home. The lambs followed as though he was the anointed messiah of all sheepdom. The faster Sam went, the faster the lambs went. He tried to lose them at the creek, but the leaders cleared it like Olympic long jumpers. Sam stuck to the road like glue except for a smart circular move through a patch of scrub, which he'd learnt from chasing foxes. But because the lambs were strung out through it, he ran into them whenever he turned. He soon dodged back to the road at even greater speed. The gates had all been left open, and Sam made full use of them. But still, the lambs followed their leader, cropping and bucking with glee. As we watched in astonishment from the rise where it all started, we could see Sam approaching the yards. The lambs were gaining on him. My mother looked up from the homestead garden and was aghast to see a line of 300 lambs heading for the yards, with not a ewe in sight. Sam hurdled the gate at the sheep yards and escaped to the safety of his kennel. All we had to do was pick up a few exhausted ewes along the way. when we finally reached the yards, my mother had already closed the gate. This event happened about 20 years ago, but I can still see the tears of laughter rolling down my dad's cheeks. Sam probably had recurring nightmares.
Hello, Dingo. A story by Carol Keevers, Sandgate, New South Wales. Having lived in a forest area on the north coast of New South Wales where dingoes were plentiful, I have developed great respect for the intelligence of our native dog. Its cunning is extraordinary. Our family has had several half-bred dingoes, but one stands out in my memory. We call him Dingo. He was the result of a furtive mating of my father's blue heeler bitch by a big red dingo, which had forced its way into a loft slab barn. Dingo, who was red like his father, was a wonderful household pet and a very intelligent farm working dog who seldom left my father's side. Because of this, he frequently used to hear my father shouting, "Hello!" to the neighbours when a telephone call came in for them. This was in the early days of telephones, and the neighbours had not yet installed one. The dog would sit by my father's feet and echo this call. One day, a friend living on a heavily timbered property nearby came to me very distressed, saying, "Something seems to be wrong across the road from me. I can hear someone calling out, 'Hello,' repeatedly as if he needs help. I've searched the scrub and called out, but no one answered." When I told him that it was probably Dingo, he was most indignant, but had a laugh about it later. After my father's death, I lived by myself in the forest area. This half-bred dingo became very protective of me and would snarl and bark savagely to prevent any stranger from entering the front gate. I well remember the look of disbelief on people's faces when I told them to say, "Hello, Dingo," to be allowed inside. As soon as they did, the snarl would be replaced by a smile and a wave of the red tail. I must admit, though, that they always kept a close eye on the dog as he followed them up the garden path.
This one we've called Sunday Stowaway, from Beth Henke at Mumbana in Victoria. It's extraordinary, you know, the length your best friend will go to so she too can go visiting on a Sunday afternoon, despite having been told to stay home. Wockie, our blue heeler cross, was as broad as she was tall, and reckoned she knew as much as a boss. On this occasion, she outsmarted even him. We set off in our old XR Falcon Ute to journey across country to the parents-in-law's for the afternoon. Wockie was determined to be part of the visit. She came with us to the first gate, but was growled at and told to stay home. We shut the gate, and when we couldn't see her, didn't think much more of it. We thought she'd slunk off through the rushes and swamp for home. We travelled on, opening and closing seven gates. We stopped to change a flat tyre, but then continued on across country and into a pine forest. We were stopped there by tourists who asked questions about the lie of the land. Suddenly, the old XR died. We opened the bonnet to investigate the problem, and there was determined old Wockie sitting between the engine and the mudguard. The tourists looked a little stunned, but the boss casually remarked, "Oh, that's where we carry our dogs in this part of the bush." In her keenness to meet the tourists' Labradors after her cramped and bumpy journey of 20 miles, she had wriggled the petrol pipe off the engine block, cutting the fuel supply to the engine. This one we've called The Duck Hunter. It's written by Peter Chandler at Casterton in Victoria. Aron was a sheepdog of great repute, known for feats of bravery while facing savage mobs of rampaging wethers, not to mention keeping packs of irate rams at bay. His most memorable feat, however, occurred one Saturday during duck season. A good mate of mine, Coop, came out to our place to go shooting on a large billabong, which is usually chock-a-block with black ducks. Coop had brought out his new duck dog, Heidi, to show off her skills. From what he'd been telling me, Heidi was going to do everything except shoot the ducks. I'd been taking in this drivel for several days by then, and finally, thank God, the dog's day had come. I couldn't have handled too many more stories about the utterly amazing super dog, Heidi. So, off we went to the billabong, Coop and me, and Heidi waddling along behind. As expected, there was a stack of ducks swimming around amongst the weed, and we were able to bag a few. One duck, however, landed smack in the middle of the water. No problem, said Coop. This is exactly what I brought Heidi along for. Well, I rolled my eyes and thought to myself, Lordy, surely I don't have to listen to this all over again while the Wonder Dog is freestyling out to bring the duck back to the bank, do I? My silent prayers, meantime, were being interrupted by the volume and tone of voice that Coop was using to command Wonder Dog to bring home the duck. After a couple of minutes, Heidi's parentage was being seriously questioned, and I don't think the dog was too impressed with the 25-kilometre walk home that Coop had generously announced to her. Needless to say, Heidi was on the bank, out of arm's reach from Coop, and the duck was still in the middle of the billabong. As neither of us was too keen on giving Heidi a practical demonstration of how to do it, I said rather jokingly that perhaps my dog, Aaron, could show us how to do it. So I ran back to the house and brought the other Wonder Dog back to the scene. Coop had that "don't be an idiot" look on his face, but I was becoming quite convinced that Aaron was up to the job. Luckily, he loved to fetch sticks and balls and return them to the thrower. So I grabbed the stone and threw it in the vicinity of the floating duck. Aaron took a mighty leap into the water and made a beeline straight for the duck. As the only thing floating out there was the duck, he immediately assumed that I'd thrown out a dead duck for him to fetch back. And he did just that, dropping it right at my feet. I just looked up at Coop and smiled. I never did hear another Heidi story.
A Lena Christmas Without Lena, written by Christine Stratton from Strathalbyn, South Australia. In September 1978, we bought 24 day-old turkeys to fatten and sell to help bring in some cash for Christmas. It had been a lean year for us. We put our two working collies, Lena and Sonny, on guard over the turkeys to ensure their safety. At 11:30, one November night, about 2 weeks before the turkeys were ready to kill and dress, we heard a terrible squawking coming from the barn where they were kept. We thought they'd be safe in the well-protected cage we'd made. The dogs had been asleep on the old settee outside the back door. They took off, barking. As they ran toward the turkey cage, they were met by a large fox with one of the biggest turkeys in its mouth. The fox raced through the fence and into the paddock with the dogs in full pursuit. We could do nothing but listen to the dogs barking as they chased the fox towards the dam. In the moonlight, we could see the dogs circling the top of the dam wall and the fox swimming for its life. The dogs refused to let it leave the water, and we found next morning that it did eventually drown. Well, there goes our Christmas dinner, I said to my husband. We'd taken orders for all but one turkey, which was to have been ours, so it looked like we would have to eat chicken. Just then, I felt something warm against my leg. There were the dogs, looking very pleased with themselves, tails wagging like windmills, as Lena dropped the large white turkey at my feet. That Christmas, no turkey ever tasted better. But I did swear the kids to secrecy until after guests had eaten. Even so, I think the bird must have died of fright because there wasn't a mark on it when I dressed it.
Like in any effective organisation, someone has to be in charge. And it certainly can't be the dog, even though that's what most of them would like. If it weren't for dogs like Peter Mercer's, that demonstrate they can think as well as obey, we'd wonder whether the agony of transforming a dog from freeloader to useful employee was worth it.
This one we've called Wash Away Wonder from Peter Mercer at Euroa in Victoria. There's great benefit from breaking in a young dog by always using the same commands, the same signals, and insisting that it does what it's told from the start. In the late 1930s, I was pleased to be given the job of Jackaroo on a beautiful property in Western Victoria. It was quite large and in a lovely red gum area. Several permanent creeks ran through wide, deep valleys, which had well-grassed, gently sloping sides. The manager was a very experienced man and good with sheepdogs. As a young man, he'd worked with Mr. Walter Field, a well-known breeder of good dogs and a successful trials man. We made inquiries in the district and soon heard of a chap who was breeding Field-type dogs. They were of medium size, with quite long hair and prick ears, all black except for a little white bib on the chest. We decided on an alert and friendly young male pup, and we called him Rod. When he got going and was under some control, I was instructed to see that he always came around behind me. When I held out my right arm and said, "Go back," he was to go to the right-hand side of the mob. If I held out my left arm and said, "Get over," he was to go to the left side of the mob. He was always expected to turn the mob and then return to me the way he'd gone out. If he crossed his cast, that is, going from my right across in front of me to the left of the mob, or the other way around, he would be spoken to severely. I stuck closely to these rules and he developed into a beautiful dog that could be used to bring home to the sheds or yard any mob without the slightest worry. One day we'd mustered about 900 young ewes and were travelling home with them along one of the broad valleys, and I stopped to block a rabbit in a hollow log. Looking up, I saw that the mob had gone around the head of a small but steeply sided washaway and was heading back to cross the creek again down below to the right. I said to Rod, "Go back," and off he went. However, he found he couldn't easily cross the washaway, so he went up to the head of it and then worked his way down the right-hand side of the mob, quickly shifting the ewes away from the steep edges as he went, turned them in the direction of home when he got to the head of the mob down near the creek, and then came slowly back to me. Over the last 50-odd years, I've seen many dogs at work and feel quite sure that a very large proportion of them would have taken the easy way, gone past the head of the gully, crossed their cast, and raced down the left side of the mob, thereby pushing the sheep towards the creek and quite probably making them splash unnecessarily through it.
Smug Susie, written by Liz Bishop, Lagan, New South Wales. As soon as she saw me, I knew we were not going to get along. It was obvious she thought I was intruding and would get no respect from her. In the beginning, I hoped I would overcome her attitude. I complimented her, gave her lots of affection, and generally went out of my way to become her friend. But to no avail. She never overcame her contempt for me. I was from the city, and she was of the country, and no way was she going to let me forget it. We started to work together along with Nippy and Lassie, who had decided if the boss thought I was all right, then I couldn't be too bad. On a typical day, we might have to bring in a mob of sheep for drenching or crutching. We would pack lunch, put the dogs in the back of the Land Rover, and set off on a bumpy cross-country trip. Being in charge made me feel quite important, but Susie just knew I had to be brought back to size. I'd open the door of the Land Rover and send the dogs off. "Go back, far back," I'd say, and two streaks of enthusiasm would race away. Susie would jump down and slowly make off at her own pace, giving me a withering glance over her shoulder. Eventually the mob would arrive, with Susie in charge. She would just gently hold them together, no mad dashing about and yapping. She knew her job and did it well, without any help from me. One day, when I had the mob to myself, the boss being away, I decided to drench them. I'd put them through there before, so saw no problems. But I didn't take Susie into account, did I? It was her moment of glory. I was totally at her mercy. I would get the mob into the race, and she would promptly put them back out. I roared, I yelled, I told her to get in the Land Rover, to go home, just get out of my day. The non-barking Susie turned into a yapping, growling, snarling monster. Not directed at me. She was just telling the mob that I wasn't the boss and not to be fooled. It wasn't long before bedlam reigned supreme, scattered sheep, shattered nerves. Then, feeling she had achieved what she had set out to do, Susie went and put herself under the Land Rover in the shade. I'll swear she laughed at me for the next hour, smug beyond words. The boss had to shoot Susie later because she had cancer. I wept to think that one of the personalities I loved in my life had gone.
This one we've called Watch and Learn. It's from Peter Murphy at Mildura in Victoria. During 1985, I was studying at a Victorian agricultural college where dogs played an integral part in the management of sheep and cattle. One of the farm staff, who was renowned for his dog breeding and training, would often sell the progeny to students. In most cases, they were students who had absolutely no use for a working dog, but fulfillment of the agricultural image required a dog to stand in the back of the ute. I knew a couple of blokes who bought these dogs, and I witnessed the world of new interests owning a dog open up to them. Among these interests was the old favourite sheepdog trials. It was at one of these trials that two college lads, clad in the appropriate bush gear, dogs by side, were questioned by Ted, a so-called expert in the field. "Are you blokes entering these dogs in the trials?" he queried. "No, mate, we've just come here to watch the event," they replied. "Probably just as well, because these dogs look pretty useless to me. Take that one. His eyes are too close together, back legs are bowed, front legs are too short," and so he continued until he'd exhausted every fault that could hinder the performance of the dogs. With their pride shattered, the pair were convinced there was no future for their dogs. Through sheer embarrassment, they hid them and returned to catch a glimpse of the master at work with his perfect dog. Patiently, they waited until finally Ted stood forward with his dog. It was his turn. A flock of sheep was released in the distance as the judge explained the rules. "Not a problem," was the confident reply from Ted. One mighty whistle, and the dog was off. Seeing the young lads nearby, Ted turned to them, smiled and said, "Watch and learn." The two were watching and couldn't believe what they were seeing. The dog was running straight for the middle of the flock, certain to cause absolute chaos. When Ted turned about, he too saw what was happening and quickly tried to remember the command that would rectify the situation and save face in front of the students. Ted cupped his hands around his mouth and as loud as he could yelled, "Split 'em!" There were roars of laughter from the crowd and then Ted's ultimate humiliation, disqualification. The lads returned to the college with their pride restored to gleefully tell the story of the great sheepdog expert. As the story floated around, it was exaggerated to the extent that Ted's commands also included, "Leave those three and kill that one." This one's The Boxer from Rod McIntyre at Pambula in New South Wales. An old cocky once told me that he liked to pick the run. I had no better theory then, so I thought I'd take a punt. It was the smallest of the litter from Dad's Kelpie bitch called Jen, my old cobber, who was really working at his prime back then. Well, he grew into a useful dog in a funny sort of way, although he had this tendency to muck around and stray. He'd go off chasing rabbits, leave me almost to despair. Yet when I really needed him, he was always there. And he seldom did the wrong thing, like split the mob in half, or push them too hard up the hills, and he'd often make us laugh. How he'd take his share of credit when the job was finally done, although Cobber had done all the work, and he'd had all the fun. Yet he had one tasteless habit, He used to mount the lambs and other creatures as they'd stay still, though he wouldn't take on rams. And oh, how it embarrassed me when the ladies were about. I used to have to lock him up and hope he wouldn't get out. I became a bloody laughingstock. I could see the people snigger. And although I tried to hush it up, I found it hard to figure. Till the Sheila up and asked me as I went walking past her, was it true what they were saying, the dogs take after their master? Now, he's not the type of dog that you'd take to any show. The distractions there would be too great if you ever let him go. And if I put him in a sheepdog trial, I'm scared that we would find he'd give a whole new meaning to the phrase, push up from behind.
Where paddocks wave and rustle like green gold taffeta, a dog can have a heap of fun. When the machines move in to cut and tie the fabric into knots, comb it into windrows, and to extract the grain, wildlife runs for its life. A dog, with time on its paws, can run down a fox, deliver a message, or even drive a ute. With the humans safely tucked up in their air-conditioned tractors or headers, or delivering grain to the silos, dogs can enjoy unfettered bliss. They can lie around in the shade watching everyone else work, or peel away to visit an obliging friend or two. Because their farms are multi-enterprise operations, these dogs have to be versatile too.
No Way Do We Part, written by Elsie Dunn of McGregor in the Australian Capital Territory. My father was a farmer at Majura in New South Wales, but we had to move when Dad's land was taken up by the government in 1900 to help form Canberra. I was five when we bought land near Burrara, between Canberra and Binalong, to re-establish our mixed farm. We grew wheat, oats, barley and lucerne. Dad also ran a lot of sheep, a few cattle, 32 bullocks for his team, and Clydesdale horses for the wagon and farm work. We each had a saddle or stock horse, and there were several for sulky and buggy work. We also bred pigs. At the age of 14, I was asked by Dad to drive 52 pigs about 2.5 miles across our paddock, then across the end of the wheat paddock, across a grazing field, through a gate, across the main road and through the gate of the man who had bought them. I set off early, riding my pony and taking my ever-faithful foxhound Patch. He was a tall, sturdy and strong dog who was always with me. It was a difficult task, keeping the pigs along the track. Without Patch, I would never have managed. It took a couple of hours to get to our gate on the main road. Nearby was a huge dam, and the hot, tired pigs immediately headed for this and wallowed in it blissfully. I saw with dismay that along the road a drover was bringing a large flock of sheep. I rode along the fence and asked if he could hold his sheep until I got my mob of pigs across the road. He called a couple of kelpies to his aid and soon had the sheep stopped. I rode back to the dam, which by now was full of wet and muddy pigs, over which Patch was standing watch. I told him to get around them, so in he dived. He swam back and forward around the pigs, snapping and barking, while I swung a stock whip and rode close to the dam's edge. Between us we got them out. I opened the boundary gate while Patch stopped the pigs from returning to the dam. I then opened the gate on the other side of the road, and we rushed them across and into the other field where the new owner was waiting, although he never offered to help. The drover came along when the road was free. He must have been impressed by our performance, as he offered to buy both my dog and horse. No way do we ever part, I told him, nevertheless feeling quite elated. Later that night, he dropped in to see my father and told him how well I'd done a very difficult task. He again offered a good price for the dog and horse, which was very flattering, but we took great delight in rejecting it.
The call is one in a state of shock from Malcolm Saipur of Maling in Western Australia. My black and tan Kelpie was 11 months old at the time of this story and was spending a lot of time with me as part of his training. During the day, between spells on the header and trips to the silo with the wheat trucks, he would sleep on the passenger side floor of the utility. Harvesting a long, narrow sand plain paddock next to the Shire Road one day, I noticed as I came round the top corner that the header steering wasn't normal. One of the back tyres was half flat due to straw stuck in the valve. Since it was too flat to carry on with, I had to walk about 1 kilometre to the other end of the paddock where the truck and the ute were parked next to a gate leading onto the road. I drove the utility, which had the compressor on the tray, back to the header to blow the tyre up again. That being done, I was faced with the problem of returning the ute to the other end of the paddock and another long walk. Because the paddock was clear, I decided to point the ute straight at the truck, put it in low-range first gear and let it get there on its own. I tied the steering wheel to the seat springs and started it off slowly back down the paddock. Carrying on with the header, I kept one eye on the progress of the ute to ensure I was near the truck when it arrived. As I went past, I saw the dog, who'd been asleep on the floor, had woken and jumped up onto the driver's seat to see what was happening. I was getting close to the truck, with a header bin nearly full of wheat, when I noticed that a car had pulled in off the road and a salesman was waiting for the ute to arrive so he could tell the driver all about his product. I stopped at the truck and left the header unloading to walk over to the ute, which was just arriving. The dog was sitting in the driver's seat, front paws on the steering wheel, being watched by the salesman, who had just realised the dog was apparently in full control. Opening the door, I pushed the gears out and turned the engine off. I casually remarked to the surprised onlooker that although the dog drove quite well, he wasn't heavy enough to work the clutch, so I had to start and stop the ute for him. Conscious of the header unloading, I quickly found out what product the salesman was selling, decided we didn't need any, hopped back on the header and carried on harvesting. The salesman, who was a stranger to the district, appeared to be suffering from mild shock as he slowly drove off. I've often wondered since whether he ever mentioned to anybody about the smart dogs in our district, or if he wakes up in the early hours and lies awake worrying if he really did see a dog driving the ute that day.
Lady Killer at Large, written by Val Pate from Renmark, South Australia. When we were first married, my husband owned a nondescript red kelpie called Sailor. He was a constant companion as well as a workmate on our partly developed property at Minganew in Western Australia, some miles from the nearest neighbour. He was also somewhat of a lady killer. In mid-January one year, we were doing some contact harvesting about 5 miles from our home for a neighbour. Just after lunch, during the hottest part of the day, we took a load of grain into the local siding, leaving Sailor with the tractor and header. We considered it would be kinder and cooler than taking him in the hot truck with us. On our return, Sailor was missing. We thought he'd taken umbrage at being left and had returned home. When we discovered he wasn't at home, we tracked him for about 8 miles along the road heading north into town until nightfall prevented us from going further. Next morning we headed into town 22 miles away and asked around if anyone had seen him. No luck. We proceeded on to visit my parents, 19 miles north of town, to be greeted by a furious father and a very contented Sailor, grinning from ear to ear. The night before, Father had locked his bitch in the shearing shed in solitary confinement for the duration of her heat, only to be greeted in the morning by 2 happy dogs lying peacefully side by side. Sailor had been with us 3 weeks earlier when we had all had Christmas with my parents. He had not seen the young lady in the interim, but had been quite prepared to walk 48 miles in the heat, somehow knowing the timing would be right. And to think we'd been feeling sorry for him.
Geoffrey Blight is round, jolly and whiskered. A farmer, musing contractor, philanthropist, entertainer and writer. The next three stories are written by Geoffrey Blight of Narrogin. To demonstrate his dog's talents, he's driven sheep and a variety of other animals through the main streets of Perth. And now a drive through Perth.
Farmers are always trying to find ways of describing the brilliance of their sheepdogs, and I'm no better. When the yarns are being told, you've got to come up with something. It was a boast I must have made 1,000 times that finally got me into trouble. As a contractor handling sheep practically every day, I always had a dog, for most of the time only one, although that changed in recent years. When talking dogs, I would often say that mine were good enough to drive sheep down Perth Main Street. This was always a convincing boast, but in the mid-80s, a reporter from the Sunday Times asked me if I'd ever tried it. I said I hadn't, but as I was doing some sheepdog publicity for the Royal Agricultural Society, I made the statement that I was giving it some thought. This statement appeared in the Times, and everyone seemed to get interested. The Agricultural Society and Perth City Council asked me if I could. My best mate, who was one of Australia's best sheepdog trialers, told me how a top trialer had done it 17 years earlier. So what the hell? Why not? I was always trying to show off my dogs, but as a new worker in the sport of sheepdog trialing, I wasn't doing too well. I was far more acquainted with the pressures of angry farmers, stupid dogs, and mean sheep on farms where I worked. Saying I would was a mistake. The first thing that happened was the animal livers went mad and wrote to the society and the council urging them not to let this idiot with marauding dogs and disorientated sheep onto their streets. They claimed that sheep would be killed running under the feet of the public. I thought this would be the end of the idea. However, the instigators urged me on and I decided to let people judge for themselves. Common sense had it that if I was to drive sheep through Perth, I'd have to walk in front and show the way. As the time drew nearer, I decided to use 5 dogs and about 25 sheep so that I could cover most situations, especially as at one part of the trip, I'd be walking within 10 feet of oncoming traffic doing 70 kilometres an hour. I'd found out that the earlier drive I'd been told about had involved only 7 wethers and 1 dog, and that the sheep had escaped soon after the press shot had been taken. My mate told me this only 2 days before the event, which really took the wind out of my sails. But I believed that I had the dogs that I could rely on and that had plenty of experiences coping when things went wrong, as they often did on the farm. On the day, the first thing that had me in a panic was the crowd. Blimey, I hadn't thought too much about the people side of things. Then there were the TV crews, ducking and diving in and out of the sheep like my neighbour's mongrel sheepdogs. The streets were to be cleared by the police, but that amounted to only a couple of officers on bikes, who weren't always able to prevent cars coming from car parks and side streets and turning up in the middle of things. As I hadn't been keen to be on my own, my daughter-in-law and 2 grandchildren came along to help. When the policeman waved me on the way, I can remember wishing then that I had old Brock. The 4 border collies and 1 kelpie I had were showing obvious nervousness. But with Regal working backwards in the front, Merle on the left, Nigger on the right, Steve pushing the rear and Gus troubleshooting, we were off on the most anxious 2.5 kilometres I'd ever walked. But those mongrel dogs didn't let me down, as very quickly they realised their job, despite considerable starting, stopping and attempted breakaways early. They rose to the occasion far better than I did. Even though Merle swiped an unsuspecting little girl's ice cream from the cone as she stared at the sheep and Gus stuck his head into the occasional bin, we made it in front of some 20,000 onlookers, but not without a price. Being warm, the bitumen road played havoc with the dog's feet, and Nigger, who had to do most of the covering, was bleeding from all 4 feet, but was still giving it his best shot. It was well into the drive when my nerves settled and I thought again of the boast I'd made 1,000 times. Good enough to drive sheep through Perth. and old Brock, about whom the boast had usually been made. He was still alive at the time in his 19th year, so I brought him a newspaper and let him see it on television.
Putting a stink on socialising. Simon is an ordinary farm lad on a dairy in southwest Western Australia. To help get the cows in, he got himself a lovely blue heeler. He was very careful to get one with a really kind nature, as he felt little would be gained by having a savage pet. Although he did have friends who took delight in owning such dogs. Cloudy was a lovable dog. As Simon gradually got him interested in the cows, he found he was often distracted by visitors. They always made such a fuss of him that Simon soon realized it was spoiling him completely. At the shed one day, Cloudy was working away exceptionally well when Simon spotted some children coming who would play with his dog. It really annoyed him. They'd been doing this far too often, and he was getting nowhere. Suddenly he had a thought. Grabbing Cloudy, he deliberately dunked him in the large pile of fresh cow manure that always built up at the end of the dairy. He made sure Cloudy was well covered with it. It must have been very confusing for Cloudy when suddenly the children rejected him and didn't allow him to jump up. They left quite quickly. A very disappointed Cloudy went back to work, much to Simon's delight. From then on, as soon as Simon saw anyone coming, he would make every effort to find some fresh manure and dunk Cloudy's front feet in it. It took Cloudy a while to get the idea that he wasn't to play with visitors, but with visitors it worked immediately. Now if you go and see Simon, you'll spot the very quiet heeler just sitting and waiting his boss's pleasure. He no longer needs to put his foot in it to make himself unpopular with visitors.
This one's called Duds. Anyone who breeds stock for sale has unsaleable culls or duds. They have to be got rid of in the best and most humane way possible to make room for fresh stock. I'd been breeding sheepdogs for a few years and selling about 40 dogs a year. A week before Christmas is a time you often take stock of things. Wanting to cut down work in the holiday season, you don't want any unwanted stock to look after. I had two dogs that were over a year old that nobody wanted. One was a Kelpie runt and too small. The other, a very rough-coated border collie and very ugly. They hadn't attracted any interest whatsoever and were costing money to feed, so they had to go. But when I went to get bullets, I found my son had taken the two packets I had, not even leaving me a single round. When I tackled Mike, my oldest son, he wanted to know what I wanted them for so urgently. After I told him, he said if I looked in his ute, I might find a couple of bullets to get me out of trouble and to get rid of the unwanted dogs. Sure enough, I found two lying among the rubbish of the glove box. I decided to dispose of the dogs immediately while I knew where the ammunition was. It didn't happen, though, as neither bullet would fire. I pointed the single-shot 22 and only... click. That night I had a call from a chap who wanted a dog. His dog had been accidentally killed, so he was impatient to replace him. A woman rang the next day wanting a dog as a Christmas present for her husband. Could he come out and pick one out? I'd several very nice pups and didn't think I'd have trouble supplying something suitable. However, when the chap arrived, he was wanting an older dog that he could start immediately. I tried to tell him the 4.5-month-old pups would work, but he wasn't convinced. I mentioned I only had a couple of one-year-old dogs that probably weren't what he wanted, but he insisted on having a look. It's crazy how some people select a dog, but this chap wanted the ugly dud the minute he saw him. He was just so much like a good dog he used to have, he had to be a good dog. I suddenly found I had a check for $200 in my hand and only one dog to shoot. I had to wait for the second chap to arrive the next morning before I could go to town and get supplies, including bullets. The chap turned out to be really fussy, and it didn't look like I had a dog to suit him. pups from an Australian champion weren't quite it, too much eye. Brothers to a state yard champion weren't it either, too much bite. A top New Zealand Hunterway pup, too boisterous, too much bark. Then he spotted the runt. What's that one, he asked. One that didn't grow, I told him. He's too small. Too small be damned. The best dog I ever had was smaller than that. Will he work, the chap asked. I wasn't sure, but there didn't seem to be any reason he shouldn't. So I let him out onto a small flock we'd been testing the dogs on. The dog hadn't even reached the sheep, and the bloke decided that was his dog. Even I was surprised at how keen the little fellow was. I wondered later if it had anything to do with me trying to shoot him 2 days earlier with a dud bullet. So it was Christmas Eve, and I had another $200 in my hand and no dogs to shoot. I'd even suggested to the bloke $150 for the runt was enough. He decided, seeing I'd kept her for over a year, the $200 was a very cheap dog. Blimey, I wish it was always that easy. But that's not the end of the story. On Christmas Day, I'm bragging to my sons about the sheer luck of the dud bullets and being able to sell the two culls the other 40 customers hadn't wanted. I even had the dud bullets still in my pocket, so I put one on the old single shot to show Mike, pointed it to the sky, and bang!